Collins. Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Tuesday, October 13th, 2020. All across the country, early voting is underway as 80 million mail-in ballots are in distribution. And the voter suppression tactics are evident. I mean, we are seeing incredible lines for early voting in Georgia and Texas just yesterday. Some of this is a product of voter suppression schemes. In Georgia, in areas like Democratic DeKalb County, in Cobb County, which is a kind of purple, and in North Georgia's Floyd County, where Trump is strong, we saw a big turnout and long lines. At least two counties had problems with the electronic poll books used to check in voters. And those are the devices that are used to see if you've taken Trump's advice and attempted to vote twice, once by mail and then at the polls. And wait time has been up to 10 hours in Georgia. And this is what we saw in the primary election over the summer. And we can't even be sure that the people who voted using these new and vulnerable ballot marking devices, BMDs, we're not sure if their votes will all be accurately counted. And this leaves many people frustrated and confused. Early voting in Texas saw long lines in San Antonio and outside Houston. Some of it is just because a lot of people are eager to vote. And others, or in other cases, it's linked to voting machine failures. Near Houston in Fort Bend County, with 400,000 registered voters, all voting machines at 30 early voting sites didn't work due to a programming glitch. And they quote, in Texas, they have many, many counties. It's like 88 or 100. I can't remember. But each county's top elected official is an elected judge. And K.P. George, a Democrat in Fort Bend County, said that more than 70% of the machines were back online after a three-hour glitch. And Fort Bend County it includes Sugar Land. And that's where Tom DeLay once held the congressional seat. He handed it off to Republican Pete Olson. Olson is retiring. The Democratic nominee, Sri Kulkarni, seems to be poised to take that seat. Is it a coincidence, then, that this is the scene of voter difficulties? And over in San Antonio, they said, we haven't had one complaint about the machines. The judge there is Nelson W. Wolf. It's just a huge turnout. And he speculated that because Texas has eliminated straight ticket voting, and that's where you just touch or click or pull one item to vote a straight Republican or Democratic ticket. He's speculating that that is leading to delays. And over in the Commonwealth of Virginia, the online voter registration portal operated like Florida's did a week ago, cutting off access online and in local registrar's office on the final day to register before the November 3rd election. They're saying that a fiber optic cable was cut just south of Richmond. Accident? Probably. But it is hard to dismiss the far-reaching voter suppression efforts of Republicans just determined that the only way they win is to keep people from voting. And I keep asking, aren't they keeping at least some Republicans from voting? I can't quite get an answer to that one. Meanwhile, back in the Lone Star State, the governor, who has decreed that there will be only one drop box for absentee ballots in each county in the state, has won a court victory. Governor Abbott, he issued that proclamation. A federal judge struck it down last week. And now, get this, a three-judge panel on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, that's in New Orleans, and all three of the judges on that panel were appointed by Donald Trump. And so they struck down the strike down of the lower court judge. And here's a quote from their opinion. You'll love this. One strains to see how it burdens voting at all. The proclamation is part of the governor's expansion of opportunities to cast an absentee ballot in Texas. Now, that simply isn't true. Anybody knows that if you restrict the number of locations where you can deliver your ballot, that becomes a barrier for some people. And as I discussed in some detail with Brad Friedman in our latest in-depth interview podcast here at peterbcollins.com, Texas already has a highly restrictive law that was tested in the courts and is going to stay in effect that limits the use of absentee ballots to the elderly, to people who can prove that they won't be at home on election day, and to people with established disabilities. Despite that narrow permission to use absentee ballots, they are erecting these barriers. One of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit that's been ping-ponged back and forth from court to court is 82-year-old Ralph Edelback. He has a disability. He lives in Cypress, northwest of Houston. And he told a newspaper that he wanted to deliver his ballot in person after he read about the widespread mail delays earlier this year. And under Governor Abbott's order, he'll have to travel 36 miles each way to return his ballot to Harris County's only allowed site. Your humble host dropped off his absentee ballot today. Right at Town Hall, there is a box, kind of like a blue mailbox. I scrutinized it carefully. I was directed there by a notice that came with the absentee ballot. So I don't have to worry that this is one of these fake ballot drops set up by the California Republican Party. Now, their fake boxes are in L.A. County, Fresno, and Orange counties. And the Secretary of State yesterday, Alex Padilla, pronounced that this is flatly illegal. But the Republicans claim that there is nothing in state law that says they can't collect these ballots and then deliver them to the local elections office. And they trotted out Hector Barajas, a spokesman for the GOP here. He said the party will continue to distribute their boxes without adding any label identifying them explicitly as Republican ballot drops. He said that state law does not restrict ballot harvesting. Now, this is a useless effort. It's very clear that California will go hugely for the Democrats. Maybe this is some sort of a stunt to please Trump or to try to, I don't know, I can't figure out a motive for it. But it doesn't help. And it's just another way that chaos is baked in to this year's election process. New York Times performed a service. I've linked to an article with graphs and everything. It's in today's paper. And it maps out state by state how the absentee mail-in ballots are processed and then tabulated, and what the state law says about when these tasks can be conducted. So, for example, in some states like Florida, anybody who submits a mail-in ballot before the election can have it processed and tabulated up to 40 days prior to Election Day. But there are a number of states where they can't even open the envelopes and see if the ballot is legitimate, if it's been filled out, if the signature requirements or witness requirements have been met, if it's in the right envelope inside the outer envelope. And two critical states, Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, are not permitted to begin pre-processing ballots until Election Day. Michigan is only allowed to begin pre-processing the day before, 10 hours before Election Day. This helps us understand a little bit. For example, Florida will have a head start in counting the big pile of absentee ballots, including the ones that come from the Donald and the Melania. And as Brad Friedman pointed out, they do not have a legal residence in Florida. There's a whole issue going back to when he bought Mar-a-Lago for 20 cents. He promised it would never be his residence. And he's just kind of bulldozed the Palm Beach authorities there. And apparently they do accept his absentee ballot. Arizona also gets a head start. And so it is going to be very interesting, as we have discussed. We believe, many of us, I don't want to use this royal we like it's me and a million other people, but many people who observe these issues believe that Trump is going to try to stop the vote counting at some point, hoping that by directing his minions, his followers, his cultists to the polling places, that we'll have a count on election night that shows Trump ahead. But in many cases, we're going to get a pretty good idea based on the number of absentee ballots that were mailed out and the number that have been returned and tabulated on election night. Now, I realize this is all very confusing, so follow the link to the New York Times, and you can see what the rules are for your state and whether its tallies will be meaningful on election night. Because of the increased costs of all of this mail-in voting and the other stipulations at the polling places to meet COVID standards, election officials have had a huge increase in costs. And there was $4 billion allocated in the so-called HEROES Act passed by the House in May to provide money to pay for these additional requirements. And since the Republicans have stonewalled that, up steps Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg and his wife Priscilla Chan. They have an entity which is not really a charity or a foundation. It's called an initiative, and under legal standards, it's set up as a limited liability company. Zuck has dumped a bunch of Facebook stock into the company, but he could actually retake it if he decided to do that down the road. So the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative had contributed $300 million to good government groups to help pay for the additional costs of elections this year, and they've just forked over an additional $100 million. Now, conservatives consider this to be interference on behalf of the dangerous libtard Democrats. And there are a number of organizations like the conservative legal group, the Thomas More Society. It's filed lawsuits in 8 states, including Michigan, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Georgia, and Iowa, seeking to block these grants from being used. In other news, the Defense Secretary, Mark Esper, on loan from his old employer, Raytheon, has declined to rule out sending active-duty military personnel to guard the polls on Election Day. He was asked by members of Congress to commit to refusing to send troops to the polls, and he offered a one-line answer. The U.S. military has acted and will continue to act in accordance with the Constitution and the law. Now, I would argue that that means he's not going to do it because posse comitatus generally prevents the military from being deployed inside our own borders. Well, we've seen Trump try to expand that, sending troops to the border to tune up their trucks, and, of course, deploying his federal goon squads to Portland and other cities this summer. And Mark Milley, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who made the bad choice to take a stroll with Trump over to St. John's Church after troops had cleared the streets in front of the White House there. Well, he said, quote, "I believe deeply in the principle of an apolitical U.S. military. In the event of a dispute over some aspect of the elections, U.S. courts and the Congress are required to resolve any disputes, not the military. I foresee no role for the U.S. armed forces in this process." So for Democrats and anti-Trumpers, people who'd like to see the Senate taken away from Republican control by the course of this election, the Cook Political Report has changed its ratings of three closely watched Senate races, and they are tepidly predicting that the Democrats are likely to regain control. They've looked at Kelly Loeffler, the interim senator from Georgia, Dan Sullivan in Alaska, who's plagued by a bit of a scandal right now, an environmental scandal, and John Cornyn of Texas. Those have all shifted from likely to lean Republican. The editor at the Cook Political Report, Jessica Taylor, said, "A drop not only in Trump's reelection numbers following his disastrous first debate and coronavirus diagnosis, but also in subsequent down-ballot GOP surveys paint a dire picture for Republicans across the board at a very precarious time." Now, you may know Democrats need to win four seats, or three plus the White House, in order to technically control the Senate. And they expect Doug Jones, the wobbly Democrat from Alabama, to be defeated. And the party is predicted to pick up Arizona and Colorado. So the trend line is looking good for the Senate. And you'd think some of those Republicans would say, hey, maybe we ought to send some cash to the voters. But they're pretty resistant to that. We'll have an update for you on coronavirus relief in a moment. One other Senate contest that people are watching is that of Tom Tillis against Cal Cunningham. And that is in North Carolina. And, of course, Cunningham shot himself in the groin after it was revealed that he had been texting with a woman who's not his wife. And some of those steamy text messages found their way to the public. And the poll was conducted just at the time that those reports surfaced. And Cunningham is still ahead of Tillis by 4 points, 48-44. Today, the Supreme Court decided that it will not take up a case brought by members of Congress suing the President of the United States for his violation of the Constitution's Emoluments Clause. And perhaps they just didn't have time to read that lengthy article in Sunday's New York Times that I referred to here yesterday, that clearly shows how people are lining Trump's pockets directly by spending money at his hotels and golf properties. And son of a bitch, if they don't get the goodies that they ask for from the federal government by talking to Trump. So the lawmakers had asked the court to review a February ruling by a three-judge panel on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which found that the senators lacked the legal right to sue the president. Well, if not Congress, who then? Well, there is still a suit alive brought by CREW, the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics Group in Washington, and a group of attorneys general. But the court's denial, of course, always without explanation, means that Democrats' petition failed to garner support from at least four justices, and it leaves the lower court ruling standing. They did that without even the ninth vote. And it's becoming increasingly clear that unless something surfaces, handmaid Amy Coney Barrett will be narrowly confirmed by the Republican-controlled Senate shortly before the election. I watched about 40 minutes of the hearing this morning, and she comes across as very bright, very capable, knowledgeable in the law. And she offers this kind of schizophrenic presentation that, oh yeah, I'm against Roe versus Wade, and I signed that letter on the way out of church one day, but that won't affect my judgment if I'm on the Supreme Court for lifetime at the age of 48. And Obamacare, oh, I'm not hostile to Obamacare. I just didn't like Justice Roberts' ruling. Abortion rights? Obamacare? Gun rights? I heard a really good civil exchange between Illinois Senator Dick Durbin and Barrett at the hearing this morning. And the case that Senator Durbin presented was of essentially a fraudster who had been convicted of a felony, served a year in federal prison, and when he got out, he was notified that as a felon, he could not possess a gun. So he sued over that. And Coney Barrett, in a dissent that was longer than the decision by the majority on her appeals court, she sided with the ex-felon. And she carved out new territory, and this is the woman who says she's a strict constructionist, a textualist who only goes by the Constitution or the text of a law. But she found a non-existent exception, saying that, well, this guy didn't commit a violent felony, so why do we prevent him from having a gun? So she's dangerous because she does a good job of making her extreme positions seem within the range of normal, and that, essentially, she delivers this in an extremely disarming manner. Talks a lot about her kids, gave a heartfelt response to a Durbin question about George Floyd, because she has adopted a black son and daughter from Haiti. And she was, pretty compelling in explaining how that freaked out her kids. Referring to there was Roe versus Wade in the 70s and the 90s. Abortion rights were upheld in the Casey case. And she said, I have no agenda to try to overrule Casey. I have an agenda to stick to the rule of law and decide cases as they come. And she's doing this dance. It's really the dance that every nominee since Ginsburg has performed. Which is to say, Senator, that is a lovely question. I wish I could answer it, but it's likely to come before the court. And so I'm going to duck. I'm going to bob and weave and do the Macarena, whatever it takes, but I'm not going to answer your question. And I think she will maintain that kind of legal stone wall through the course of these hearings. Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island didn't ask her any questions. In his time, I think they get half an hour, maybe. I couldn't quite tell. Whitehouse presented a sequence of slides. There were charts and information about the role of the corporate-funded Federalist Society in picking judges for Trump. Barrett belonged to the Federalist Society from 2005 to 2006, and then again from 2014 to 2017. Then she resigned when she became an appeals court judge in Chicago, but continued to accept speaking fees and address meetings of the Federalist Society. So, I give Whitehouse high marks because I do think that it shows that she is a protege of corporate interests, including the Kochs. And when asked about important precedents, she cited the woman whose seat she will likely be taking, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, quote, "No hints, no forecasts, no previews." And Barrett said that had been the practice of nominees before her, but everybody calls it the Ginsburg rule because she stated it so concisely, and it's been the practice of every nominee since. And it's kind of ironic to note that Ginsburg herself didn't uphold the Ginsburg rule because she was willing to honestly comment about her positions on abortion rights at her confirmation hearing. And I think she was confirmed 98, something like that, over 95 votes in the Senate. Barrett insists her Catholic beliefs will not affect her rulings, that she knew upon nomination that her faith would be caricatured, including her involvement in People of Praise, which I consider to be a religious cult. And what's interesting is that so far, from what I've read and what I have seen, which is not everything, it's only the Republicans who are bringing up her religion. And they're bringing it up in a way that demonizes Democrats for even thinking about linking her religion to her ultra-conservative legal views. And I'm fearful, as I expressed yesterday, that the Democrats will stick to this bad strategy and not bring up her religion, even in contexts where it is quite problematic. And here's a summary article from the Washington Post today, described as early takeaways from Barrett's Supreme Court hearing. Item one, Barrett wouldn't comment on how she might decide any precedential issues, except to offer reassurance that she adheres to stare decisis. And I remember Arlen Specter, the senator from Pennsylvania, who quizzed nominees on what he called super-duper precedents. And this is a standard song and dance that we have seen going on for years now, and she is sticking with the script. On major questions about settled law, Barrett dodged. She wouldn't say how she would rule on whether a president can delay an election. She wouldn't commit to recusing herself from a case in which she might have a conflict of interest, nor on how she would rule on a huge case coming up before the court in November, the Affordable Care Act, and she simply said she's not hostile to it. And when asked about the linkage between Obamacare and protection for people with pre-existing conditions who can still get insurance, she seemed oblivious to the connection there, as if she could help strike down the law on technicalities, and then magically the protection for those with pre-existing conditions would remain in place. Interesting op-ed that I've linked to in today's show file. It appeared at the New York Times under the byline of Wajahat Ali. And he asked the basic question, how would Republicans behave if Judge Barrett were a Democrat whose strongly held religious beliefs came from Islam instead of Catholicism? He speculates, Republicans would demand she prove that she was not working with our enemies. That's what Glenn Beck, the conservative media host, called for when Keith Ellison was elected as the first Muslim in Congress. He continues, they'd probably use her faith to accuse her of hoping to create a Sharia state through judicial activism. That's what conservative bloggers did in 2011 when Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey nominated Sohail Mohammed, a Muslim originally from India, for a seat on a superior court. And one more, he says, if Judge Barrett wore a hijab, Jeanine Pirro, the Fox News host and a former judge, would question whether Her religious beliefs were in opposition to the Constitution. And that's the ugly accusation that Pirro levied against Representative Ilhan Omar in 2019. I think it's a good question. And we know pretty well what the answer is. Well, we're learning now that the plot hatched by members of Michigan's self-styled militia who wanted to kidnap their governor, Gretchen Whitmer, they also discussed a similar action against the governor of Virginia, Ralph Northam, because he and Whitmer had imposed aggressive lockdown orders to restrict the spread of coronavirus. Both governors were apparently targeted. Michigan lifted its restrictions on June 1st, but prohibited bars from offering indoor service in July. And the Michigan Supreme Court, with a Republican majority, ruled that the law that Governor Whitmer had been using to issue her emergency orders was unconstitutional. And we learn a little bit more that the recorded intercepts of some of the plotters said that the so-called Wolverine watchman had expressed their suspicions that government informants were monitoring or had infiltrated their group. At one point, after a planning trip to case the governor's vacation home in the surrounding area, one of the principals, Adam Fox, asked that all participants be scanned with a device that they thought would identify if anyone was wearing a transmission wire or a recording device. And that leads to this important analytical piece by Raul Diego, published today at Mint Press News. And he takes us back, and I give him credit for making these links to the Ruby Ridge standoff led by a former Marine named Randy Weaver. And that was a 1970s event. And Diego writes, stoked for decades by an extremist capitalist oligarchy, which has slowly and methodically disabled the levers of democracy to achieve its interest, the latent racial tensions that haunt America's collective psyche are being exploited in ways never before possible with the advent of online disinformation mashups, like QAnon, Antifa, BLM, and others along the spectrum of modern-day social media constructs. He says, as we approach the election, the skeletons in America's closet are being dressed in the latest fashion and paraded before a terrified citizenry. And he describes some of the history of Ruby Ridge, and he makes the connection that a couple of days before the FBI went public and busted the alleged conspirators in the Whitmer scheme, outside Detroit, in a northern suburb, FBI agents engaged in a shootout that killed 43-year-old Eric Mark Matthew Allport. And it turns out that his father, whose name is Bill Greider, was at Ruby Ridge, and he played the role of a kind of intermediary. He would go back and forth between the U.S. Marshals and Weaver, Randy Weaver. And he later said that he was going to kill Weaver and that the government wouldn't have to pay him. So then Diego comments on one of the sheriffs in the state of Michigan from Barry County. His name is Dar Leaf. And he unequivocally stated in an interview that the kidnapping of Whitmer, in his eyes, should be treated as an attempt by concerned citizens to make a felony arrest of the governor for violating the Constitution. And Sheriff Leaf had earlier been captured on video at a rally with one of the Wolverine suspects. So while Whitmer was under speculation as a possible running mate for Joe Biden, the FBI was infiltrating this group. They recorded hours of conversations. And of course, as always, we don't know what role they played as agents provocateur. And I credit Diego for raising the question about whether the Whitmer plotters, with their FBI paid informants and undercover agents, were the subjects of entrapment. And I have to say, you look at the mug shots of these would-be militia members, and it's pretty easy just to say, oh, the FBI got this one right. But Diego has appropriate skepticism here because we've seen hundreds of cases of Muslim Americans framed by the FBI for allegedly plotting domestic terrorism events. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Fine folks on both sides like Malachi DeLorenzo, Suzanne Bowen, let me turn the page here, Aidan McAleer, and the incredible Faith Peoples. I appreciate each and every one of you. Thank you for your support, some of it for years now. Some of you have multiple subscriptions. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart. It's not too late for you to make a contribution to support my work here. Just go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Yesterday, we shared with you some of the leaks from a Republican Senate conference call on Saturday, where senators like Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee flatly said that they didn't want to support any more COVID relief money coming out of Washington, particularly if it has Nancy Pelosi's fingerprints on it. And this does leave Trump and the majority leader, Mitch McConnell, with a very hard slog to try to get any money out of Washington and in people's hands before the election. So Mitch announced today that he plans to have the Senate vote on targeted relief for American workers, including new funding for the Paycheck Protection Program, before the election. Speaking at an event in Kentucky, he said the legislation would also likely have funds for schools, hospitals, and supplemental unemployment insurance benefits. This is one of what they describe as a skinny bill. But since Republicans have said it has to be under $1 trillion, it's hard to imagine how you could have meaningful funding in any of the programs that I just ticked off. $1 trillion simply is not enough. And so McConnell is running a gauntlet here. And Pelosi had a good line, although it does remind people that she got caught in a beauty salon that was supposed to be shut down in San Francisco. She was having her hair done, and unfortunately her COVID mask was down around her neck at the time. A surveillance camera captured her. Anyway, her line to Steve Mnuchin, "Are you giving haircuts, or are you just chopping off heads?" Pelosi told her colleagues, "We really need to have an agreement, but we can't have an agreement by just folding. I don't think our leverage has ever been greater than it is now." I appreciate that a couple of Congress members are saying, "Take it, take it, take it." Take it? Even the president is saying, "Go big or go home." But I think those Republicans in the Senate are so partisan and so desperate because they bet on Trump, and that's now clearly a losing proposition, particularly for, I think it's 22 Republican senators who are up for re-election. And last night in Kentucky, there was a debate in Lexington between Mitch McConnell and Amy McGrath, the fighter pilot who, is she a fighter pilot or just an ex-Marine? I get a little confused. There's MJ Haggerty in Texas, and I think she's a pilot. Anyway, McGrath, who I do not think is likely to beat Mitch McConnell, nevertheless got him in a debate. She said that the House passed a bill in May and this Senate went on vacation. And as McConnell chuckled, she continued, "I mean, you just don't do that. You negotiate, Senator. It's a national crisis. You knew that the coronavirus wasn't going to end at the end of July. We knew that. McConnell tried to interrupt, but McGrath continued, "If you want to call yourself a leader, you've got to get things done. And those of us who served in the Marines, we don't just point fingers at the other side. We get the job done." So McConnell blamed Pelosi. "Look, I know how to make deals. I made three major deals with Joe Biden during the Obama era. What the problem is here is the unwillingness of the speaker to make a deal." And that's flatly untrue. She made it clear that the $3 trillion Heroes Act was a shopping list. So McConnell continued, "She mentioned she was in the Marines about every other sentence. I think her entire campaign is, she's a Marine, she's a mom, and I've been in Washington too long." And McGrath retorted, "Senator, you've been there for 36 years. How's it looking, Kentucky?" Well, she's given it a fight. She is barely progressive. I mean, her politics are much closer to Mitch McConnell than Nancy Pelosi. But even that, I don't think, will prevail in deep red Kentucky. Interesting case that has come up here at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco. And this one favors the rights of journalists in protest/riot zones. And it originates from Portland, where a federal judge who reviewed the evidence found that most of the protests had been peaceful, and he held that journalists and legal observers had the right to stay at a location where police had ordered people to disperse so that they could watch the dispersal or non-dispersal. The original case came from Judge Michael Simon in Portland, who issued an injunction August 20th, protecting journalists from arrest for remaining when protesters are ordered to disperse. So in a 2-1 decision, the Ninth Circuit panel said the press plays a vitally important role in holding government accountable, and that it was clear that officers in Portland had targeted journalists for retaliation. Trump is back on the mob rally circuit. He's got one planned for just about every night this week. Then I think he's going to go to doubles, where he hits more than one city a day. And in Central Florida, Sanford last night, according to the Associated Press, no social distancing, mask wearing was spotty. Thousands came to see him. And he's doing this a lot, where he sets up these rallies at airports, and he uses Air Force One as a backdrop. And this, again, skirts up against the use of his office for his political campaign. It's called the Hatch Act. But he feels immune from the virus and immune from the law. He said, "I feel so powerful. I'll walk into that audience. I'll walk in there. I'll kiss everyone in that audience. I'll kiss the guys and the beautiful women, everybody. I'll just give you a big fat kiss." I don't know that there were any takers for that. And at the rally in Florida, he slipped in, one of those things like he used to say Mexico's going to pay for the wall, and now he just uses the wall itself for an applause line and moves on. So he got a round of applause about Obamagate. And as you know, I do believe there's something there. The origins of the Russiagate investigation. But now he apparently has accepted that Bill Barr and his handpicked U.S. attorney, John Durham, are not going to produce before the election. But as he told his loyal fans, "We'll take care of it all after the election. We caught him cold. Bad people. Crooked Hillary. And by the way, Obama and Biden knew everything that was happening. We'll take care of it after the election." And in a speculative opinion piece at the Washington Post, Greg Sargent says that Trump is trying to use the same playbook from 2016, but this time he is the incumbent. He has a record to defend, and as much as he plays the outsider, people can hold him accountable, and they have something tangible to vote on or vote against. And Sargent writes, "That makes an 11th-hour intervention less likely to succeed in effecting a broad last-minute shift. And also, with so many people voting early, so many people voting by mail and submitting those ballots early, An effort for a last-minute smear or stunt doesn't have the impact that it used to. Well, this is a little dark, but we know that Trump and Stephen Miller have been scheming all along to essentially shut down the southern border. They imposed these bizarre rules for asylum, where if you're from Honduras, you got to go to El Salvador before you can request asylum in the United States. And also using COVID as a smokescreen to say, oh, we've got to seal our border to keep that virus from coming across. And so there are some troubling anecdotes of individuals who were dropped off just over the border in the Mexican state of Sonora in a little town called Sasabe. It's only 2,500 people. It's only got one little grocery store. And advocates have reported, and this includes some nuns who are human rights activists, we've got hungry people being dumped into this community by the hundreds. I've never seen so much activity in that area. Many of them are pushed out into the Mexican desert, which can be deadly. And in fact, they are reporting that more human remains have been recovered in the Arizona desert this year than at any point since 2013. And these are tagged as Title 42 expulsions, where agents will sometimes track a group of migrants for days before they make an arrest, allowing their physical exhaustion to assist in the apprehension efforts. More than 147,000 people have been expelled. I don't have an exact timeline here, but it looks like over the past 6 months. In New York City, strike is no longer permitted. That was Mike Bloomberg's invention. He actually tried to end it, and then Bill de Blasio, who took over from Bloomberg, officially killed that policy. But now we have a series of reports, and it's under the byline of Alice Sperry at The Intercept today, that individuals, and you won't be surprised, they're black and they're brown, report that officers in plain clothes will pull up either in an unmarked car or a squad car, approach individuals, ask them what they're doing, demand their ID, then they run the ID. And they claim they're looking for people with warrants. And if anything, they release them without an apology or an explanation. So now there is a lawsuit brought by the ACLU against the NYPD. And here's a quote from the Legal Aid Society's Molly Graffard. When they want to run warrant checks and record searches on the majority of people they stop, it is a continuation of their racist stop-and-frisk practices, but with an invasive digital component. Black and Latino New Yorkers accounted for more than 90% of reported stops in at least 30 precincts in the Big Apple. Kevin Gostola has a report published today at Consortium News about Tulsi Gabbard, the congresswoman from Hawaii and presidential candidate last year. She has proposed reforms to the U.S. Espionage Act to allow an expression of what the intention of the individual was and to exclude people who are whistleblowers and who didn't violate a security clearance, like Chelsea Manning and a number of others. And since 1917, when the Espionage Act was put into place, there have only been three proposals for reforming it. And Ron Wyden, the senator from Oregon, along with Silicon Valley Congressman Ro Khanna, introduced a reform version in March. But it didn't actually cover the people that Gabbard's bill does, which would include Ed Snowden, Chelsea Manning, and Julian Assange, even though he's not an American. So I recommend this article to you, and there is a link in the show file for you to easily access it. Also, I want to recommend a piece published at the Gray Zone Project today, and it was written by Fidel Narvaez. He is a former diplomat for the nation of Ecuador. He was posted in London. Julian Assange processed his political asylum and regularly communicated with Assange over the years he was holed up at that embassy. And at the Gray Zone, he's published a list of the reasons why the Julian Assange case threat freedom of speech if he is in fact extradited and tried in the United States. And I'll just list them for you here briefly, and there's an explanation for each one you can find by clicking on the link and reading the article. Number one, the accusation is for a political crime, which is not subject to extradition. Publishing classified and truthful information is not a crime. Two, there never was a reckless disclosure of names. No one has been hurt due to WikiLeaks publications. Number three, their publications are truthful information that is historically relevant. Number four, WikiLeaks was not the first to publish the diplomatic cables without redaction, but Julian Assange is being persecuted or prosecuted. Assange never helped Chelsea Manning access national security information. That was proven in the hearing. Assange would not have a fair trial in the U.S. I think that's obvious on the face of it, and that he would face inhumane conditions and suicide risk if he is imprisoned here in the United States. Here's today's COVID-19 update, edited by Linda Lewis. We have 41,653 new cases reported yesterday, with 317 new deaths, bringing the U.S. total to 215,550. And according to the New York Times, countries across Europe are desperately trying to hold at bay a fast-growing wave of new virus cases. They're using targeted closures and travel restrictions to avoid the large-scale lockdowns used in the spring. The European Union adopted new guidelines aimed at coordinating their travel measures. They're now using a single map with a color-coded system. Other measures include unifying how quarantines and testing are done. All of these measures are not mandatory, and individual member states said they wanted to reserve the right to take their own actions. The Czech Republic, which has reported more cases per capita in the last 7 days than most European countries, announced it'll close schools on Wednesday. Restaurants and bars will be restricted to takeout orders starting on Wednesday and will be required to close at 8 p.m. In Britain, Prime Minister Bojo, that's Boris Johnson, has also sought to avoid a lockdown, brushing aside advice from an influential group of scientists. And according to the New York Times as well, even after surviving COVID-19, many patients who are critically ill face long and arduous recoveries, often requiring extensive physical rehab. Some patients suffer muscle atrophy, kidney damage, reduced lung capacity, making it difficult for them to leave their homes or get out of bed. Many struggle with cognitive and psychological issues like memory loss, depression, anxiety. Among the most common problems they face are shortness of breath, fatigue, confusion, and body aches. And it has a name, this phenomenon, post-intensive care syndrome. And they cite Dr. Michelle Beal from the Cleveland Clinic. A lot of us are still dealing with the initial crisis, the patients in the hospital and the ICU. But as a healthcare system, we need to get better prepared and organized for what's coming, which is going to be a lot of patients needing specialty care. A study in Italy found that 87% of people who were hospitalized for COVID-19 had at least one persistent health problem, like joint pain, fatigue, labored breathing, 2 months after they fell sick. About 44% of the patients in the study reported a worsening quality of life. And another study at NYU Medical School found that 74% of COVID patients continued having shortness of breath a month after they left the hospital. And we don't know about deeper issues like scarred lungs, damaged inner organs like kidneys and livers? There's a lot we don't know. In the Lancet Infectious Diseases Journal, a study shows that COVID-19 reinfection here in the United States has been confirmed, and they call it the first case. But I've reported to you before, and these are anecdotal. There's no huge list of people who've gotten it twice, but I can recall reporting at least two other instances. This new one is a 25-year-old Nevada man infected with two distinct variants of the SARS-CoV-2 within a 48-day time frame. The second infection was more severe than the first, resulting in the patient being hospitalized with oxygen support. Rahm Emanuel has a brother who's a health policy guy. He served in the Obama administration. This would be Ezekiel Emanuel, and he was interviewed at Stat News about the Regeneron monoclonal antibodies. See, I summoned that from my memory. That were given to the president on a compassionate use basis. And Emanuel is critical of that because he said, why didn't he just join a trial? Because then we would have a better understanding of whether the drugs work or not. And because he was given the Regeneron antibodies, as well as remdesivir and the powerful steroid, well, I guess the president gets to avoid being a test subject, a guinea pig. But I think Emanuel makes an interesting case here. And finally, from Linda's report, there is a new documentary, and it comes from Alex Gibbs, and Gibney, I'm sorry. He produced Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room, Taxi to the Dark Side, and many other documentaries. And this new one was shot with the COVID-19 production skills. They sent cameras to each of the subjects so they didn't have to be interviewed with another person present. And the film's most basic explanation is that the pandemic has become a political football, a battle between science and those who choose loyalty over facts. It becomes a pitch-black running joke whenever a scientist's explanation is immediately preceded or followed by Trump parroting wishful thinking ideas about how this disease is going to go away by itself. We've got it totally under control, Trump says, at least six times in this new film. And I believe it is available on Hulu. Oh, here we go. Apple TV, iTunes, Amazon Prime, Fandango, Google Play, YouTube, Vudu, and Hulu. You can check it out. Also in my COVID file, Johnson & Johnson has paused the large late-stage clinical trial of its coronavirus vaccine because of an unexplained illness in one of the participants. They didn't say whether this sick person had received the vaccine or a placebo. The pause was first reported by the health news website Stat, and this morning shares of Johnson & Johnson fell about 2%. J&J has just begun the so-called Phase 3 trial, and they're targeting up to 60,000 volunteers. This is a common process. We saw it with the AstraZeneca trial in that's based in England. They may have had people all across the world. And so we'll see if that indicates that the vaccine is a failure or if other issues were involved. Anthony Fauci is warning the Trump campaign that the edited soundbite that they used in a commercial that makes it sound like Fauci has praised Trump for his response to the pandemic. Fauci is fighting back. He says, I've been a public servant for five decades now. I've never either directly or indirectly endorsed any political candidate. This ad clearly implies strongly that I'm endorsing a candidate, and I've not given them my permission to do that. And in addition, the quote that they took is completely out of context. Alan McLeod at Mint Press reports that the World Health Organization is using the pandemic to force nations that are seeking bailout money to adopt measures that often lead to deep cuts in medical care. So the criminal financial world's response to COVID-19 is to cut the funding in countries where people already lack sufficient access to health care. And McLeod reports that 76 of 91 loans negotiated with 81 nations since the beginning of the pandemic in March come attached with demands that countries adopt measures like deep cuts to public services and pensions. And Oxfam International has identified at least 14 countries it expects will imminently freeze or cut public sector wages and jobs. Yeah, that'll fix it, for sure. And finally today, from the Foreign Desk, a couple of quick updates. Kyrgyzstan's president yesterday ordered a new week-long state of emergency in the country's capital after the parliament failed to consider and approve his previous order within the legally required 3 days. The protests have been ongoing there in Bishkek for a while. In Belarus, the protests enter their third month after what is viewed as the fraudulent re-election of President for life, Alexander Lukashenko. 713 people arrested on Sunday, and as of Monday, almost 600 of them were still behind bars. Armenia and Azerbaijan have accused each other of attacks over the separatist territory of Nagorno-Karabakh, despite a ceasefire deal brokered by Russia that went into effect on Saturday. Now, I want to acknowledge that this is a hot war over this area called Nagorno-Karabakh, and it's something I don't know enough about, so I have not been covering it or commenting on it. But I've asked my friend, former CBS Radio News correspondent, Terry Phillips, who is an expert. He said he knows too much about this situation. He's covered both sides of it, and he will be joining me for an in-depth interview scheduled for Thursday this week. And finally, I want to recommend a piece by Max Blumenthal at the Gray Zone Project, where he notes that Roger Waters, the former member of Pink Floyd, who's become quite an outspoken activist, that he was sabotaged by human rights groups like Amnesty International. So Roger Waters had signed on to appear in an event which is drawing attention to the plight of Steven Danziger. He was the guy who won the court judgment in Ecuador against Texaco, now owned by Chevron. And he's been a prisoner in his own home for over a year now, behind a contempt of court ruling from a judge in New York. So there was this event, and initially, Amnesty International tweeted a promotional message for it, and then they took that down. And when Blumenthal investigated, he found it's because Roger Waters has been critical of the white helmets and the other conditions in the 10-year-old war in Syria. And because of his outspokenness on that, because presumably Amnesty supports the white helmets, which appears to be a front group, they responded in that manner. It's quite a report. Max Blumenthal's at the top of his game. Check it out. Follow the link at peterbcollins.com. Thanks for joining me today for my news and comment podcast all the way to the end here. I appreciate it. You're free to share it everywhere. You'll find it on YouTube. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.